Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Can you hear me on the phone?
I do. I've got you coming out of every orifice.
I'm really not, you're breaking up quite badly.
Hello and welcome to The Lock-In, where I finally get to talk to people I want to hear from in a place I want to be, the pub.
For some reason, this bloody thing has started playing back some rubbish.
Oh, right.
Where were we? I forgot.
I have too.
Hello, we're locked in today with someone destined to drag, clanking behind them, the initials MP. This is the first MP on this podcast, and this is definitely not because I'm missing them. I am not. But Naz Shah is not like any other MP I know. She won the seat of Bradford West in the 2015 election, taking it from that charlatan George Galloway, which is another reason to like her. Her mother did time in prison for killing her abusive partner, again not common. Her family come from Pakistan. Naz, did you always want to be an MP?
Oh, no, not at all. I only decided to actually tried to become an MP in 2014, and I was elected within a year of having the first conversation. So it definitely wasn't part of my career trajectory originally, no.
What did you imagine you'd be doing?
I'd had all sorts of ideas. So my background is public sector, and I'm passionate about leadership development. So I was doing a lot of work on leadership development, and I still do that. And I was even considering retraining and going back to college and retraining as a barrister. That was something that I was interested in doing because I'm quite a litigious type of person. So, yeah, there was lots of options, but MP wasn't on the top of the list, that's for sure.
But it was on the list, was it?
No, not till... So in 2014, so Galloway came to Bradford and there we had the earthquake, if you like, because he took the seat from the Labour Party. And at the time, Ed Miliband came and we had a big post-mortem of what happened. And it turned out that it was because of the issue of Bradley politics, clan politics, where a patriarchal model of politics and men hold positions of power for the sake of holding positions of power. And Galloway originally had said that he was going to break that system of Pakistani model of politics, which was undemocratic. So he got my vote in 2012 when he came to Bradford. And then by 2014, he was just never around. He was really an absentee MP. And when an MP came up to Bradford to kind of find out whether they could turn it into an all-women shortlist and said to me, would you consider it? And I said, no, don't be daft. It's the dirtiest place and it's a man's world. And he threw down the gauntlet. He said, well, if you're not going to get in it, who's going to clean it up? You've got to be part of a solution. And the rest, as they say, is history. So that was on the 1st of June 2014. On the 6th, 7th of May, you know, for the next year, I was elected to Parliament. Because I felt like, you know, I could do a better job than George Galloway because he was never around. And I wanted to represent my community in Bradford. And I just, you know, I'm born in Bradford West, raised in Bradford West. So I thought, yeah, why not? Put your money where your mouth is, Naz. And nearly six years now, and here I am talking to you.
How do you define your community?
Oh, my community of Bradford. But my community, I see all of Bradford as my community, really. Although I'm the MP for Bradford West and we've got five other MPs, I think Bradford is, you know, in the elections, people have referred to it, as my Tory opponents have referred to it, as Planet Bradford, because Bradford's had a really hard deal. So that my community is where, you know, I've lived in lots of different areas of Bradford West. I went to a couple of different schools because my mum moved around a lot. So I've... So, yeah, my community is really, really everybody in every fellow Bradfordian, really. And then, obviously, I come from Pakistani heritage and Pakistani background. And I've experienced my issues of patriarchy and misogyny and all the rest of it with the that community that I belong to. So that was also something that I wanted to work with, you know, work with the community, because I think there's a beauty of, you know, I fell in love with the idea of leadership during my NHS days, and I just think there's a beauty of having a proper democracy and having people empowered, because I firmly believe people have their own solutions to issues. So it's about empowerment and leadership for me. But yeah, Bradford West is an interesting seat in the whole of the UK, really, especially when you've had people like Galloway there, and then we had Salma Yacoub there a couple of years afterwards. You know, so it's a... And it was the dirtiest campaign until Sadiq Khan's campaign came along. It was the most vitriolic, gutter campaign ever ran on British soil. And I survived it.
Do the men in your community think you're a threat?
The majority of them are absolutely brilliant. I think there's a pocket of them that feel really, really threatened. And when I did in 2016, when Samia Shahid was taken to Pakistan and she was brutally raped and murdered, and that was a clear case of honour killing. At that point, the difference I saw, Jeremy, was 25 years ago when I was campaigning for my mum, people wouldn't openly support me. And then here I was 25 years later, the businesses of Bradford came along and supported the work that I was doing. So the majority of them are absolutely brilliant. But then there's a handful of them who, you know, I'm a big threat to Bradley politics. I'm a big threat to this hold on power that the men had. And I've smashed that idea that you can have democracy and it's not about having power for the sake of power and you can have representation. But yeah, that was, there are still, oh God, there's still, you know, I mean, that's in politics generally, isn't it? You know, you get into a position of power, there's always people who feel threatened by that. And I suppose I'm a bit of a Marmite character to some of the men in the community.
How much have you been seduced by the sloganising of politics? You know, you're in Westminster. Everybody on that side of the house does it wrong. Everyone on your side of the house does it right. How much have you given into that?
Well, to some degree, we all have to when you're the official opposition, you've got to do some of that. But it's like last week's budget debate. I was really clear that I'm not going to complain. I want to work with government. You're the people in power, so I need to work with you to get some investment into Bradford. So I will work with government as long as it gets a benefit for Bradford West. I'm really not, you know, so on the in official speeches and when we're you know, pointing out where I think the government are going wrong, I'll do that. But equally, I see the power of working with government. And I saw that when we did the COVID bill in 2020 in March, and I got an amendment to the burial amendment to secure burial rights for Muslims and Jews. So that was really, you know, then I really, really felt the impact of working together with government to get legislation through and to be able to influence. And that, you know, I like that. That experience was really good.
What do you think of the way that Parliament operates?
Oh, it's a bit archaic. But you know what? I'll tell you what I have been seduced by is, you know, when I came into politics, I was kind of like a real activist background. And when I came in, you know, there was this whole conversation about restoring Parliament at the cost of a taxpayer. And then when you go into the building and you realise, you kind of like, you realise the monumental position that building holds in our psyche, in our country. So I fell in love with the idea of preserving that. which I wasn't necessarily, I'd never had a strong opinion against it, but I was questioning myself on that. So that, you know, those kind of things I have, and I love the idea when I, especially because I'm of Pakistani heritage, and I look at the democracy in other countries, and I think where they're at, and how, you know, I like the idea of accountability that we've got in our system, which isn't in other systems. So I like that idea. Having said that, you know, in the last 6 months to a year, where we've seen the kind of cronyism that's happened, that does worry me. That does worry me because it doesn't have the accountability of you know, taxpayers' money. That bit I struggle with. That bit I do struggle with.
So you are in favour of spending all these billions of pounds restoring that building, are you?
I think Parliament is so significant in terms of the world as a heritage site, as where things happened and what. I don't know whether I'd be in favour of, you know, so Parliament, the building, how it works, might not work efficiently as in, you know, in some modern parliaments do, and how the building is situated. But I wouldn't want to see us losing the Palace of Westminster as an institution for the British public and for the world to see. That building itself, you know, the history of the building, I quite like it.
You've sold out.
I don't think I've sold out. There's still no... So if we even... I mean, there's been ideas about turning it into a museum, turning it into a tourist attraction. I think there's so much history there, I'd hate to lose history. And one of the things that I like about Britain is that we do preserve history. One of the things I don't like about Britain is that, you know, we don't... We you know, this whole conversation of BLM and having these, you know, having the curriculum which talks about our history without, you know, airbrushing the edges which aren't comfortable. I think that bit I don't like about it, but I do like the idea of understanding history. I think it empowers, it really, really teaches us as a person, especially as somebody who's not been to university, who didn't have a degree in history or economics or politics. You know, I'm on a learning journey myself. I think going into Parliament, the 6 years that I've done being an MP, I think I've got, I'm on my own kind of degree of learning here about history and what that means and how the British are and what does it mean to be British. All of that thing, I find it fascinating, just learning about the stuff. I really do.
You almost sound as if you've come to love it a bit.
I'm not sure. I love democracy. I love the idea of democracy. If I could package it and put it in places like Pakistan, I'd love to do that. And the reason I'd love to do that is I see where women are empowered, what differences that they can make. And when you've got education for children, what differences that can make. So because I spent a couple of years in Pakistan as a teenager. So I've got huge, huge attachment there. And it's my, you know, it's a land of my parents. So I do see that there is something from here that I'd love to take and, you know, infuse it in that, in the ways that they work. But so I love that bit. I think what I struggle with now in these last 6 years, Jeremy, is where the road that we've taken into politics, which is very, very divisional, very, very, it's either or against, and there's no middle ground of you know, post-Trumpism, post all of that. I struggle with that hatred, the level of hatred and vitriol that has entered politics. That bit I really, really struggle with, and I don't love that at all. You know, is it, you know, and I really struggle with, you know, when I encourage other women to come into politics, I hate the idea that, you know, if you take a public position, the kind of abuse that you'd get, the kind of, you know, that's horrible. I mean, I won a libel case against Leave EU in October. So Leave EU called me a grooming gang apologist, and they said it was satire. But that kind of stuff isn't satire. It's really, really... You know, I've got 25 years of history of working around women's issues and the issues of abuse against women. And then you have that kind of... that Islamophobia, that racism, that post-Brexit stuff. That's a bit that really disheartens me. So I don't think I'm in love with it. I love the idea of democracy, but I'm certainly not in love with politics as where it's at right now. I really, really struggle with a lot of it.
And what do you think about Pakistan?
I think Pakistan's got huge challenges. I think, you know, I try not, because one of my staff takes a lot of interest in Pakistan because his brother's in Pakistan, and he fills me in every couple of months. We have a conversation about it, but I do have a lot of a diaspora community in Bradford West. So for that reason, when it affects people, like when COVID happened, when the flights weren't, you know, we were trying to repatriate people, those times I have to link in with the Pakistani authorities. I've had to link in with the Pakistani authorities when it came to the Samia Shahid murder. And I'm glad that they did take the response, although I still haven't seen any justice for Samia. I think it's a relatively young country. It's less than 75 years old. It's got a long, long way to go. You know, our democracy in comparison is hundreds and hundreds of years old. You know, so I think it's got a long way to go. But I think, So I've been to Pakistan. We've done, as part of the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, we went over and I led a delegation. But I want to go back, and I want to show my kids haven't been to, you know, I've got a 17-year-old she's going to be 17 next month. She only went over when she was a baby, when she was one. So I want to take my children over at some point once COVID is done. And we've got to, you know, because my boys haven't seen Pakistan. They don't know what I talk about or what their grandma talks about. You know, they're now 9 and 13. So I do want to take them over at some point.
But your experience of Pakistan was pretty horrible part of it.
Oh, it was horrific. Some of it was horrific. So I stayed in a village. I went to a local school. The things that I experienced there, having a forced marriage at the age of 15, you know, I was robbed of my childhood. I feel like that was a turning point for me, is just, you know, playing out with the boys and taking the dog for a walk. There's beautiful things about it in terms of the culture and stuff, but the stuff that I experienced from some of that patriarchal mindset was absolutely horrendous.
And yet you don't castigate the whole country for propagating that mindset.
No, because I think it's so for me, one of the things that has been my saving, if you like, or my the thing that's really helped me through, is the association of understanding what Islam means to me. And when my mum went to prison, Jeremy, I used to think, you know, it was Muslim men and it was about Muslims. And actually, if my mum had been threat by Muslim men as a Muslim woman, she'd have been protected. She wouldn't have been ostracized like she was. I wouldn't have experienced that, because now I raise my children. My children are very liberal-minded. They're very British. They're very, you know, outward-looking. The world is their oyster. But they still have lots of strength in them that comes from their religion, from their Islam and being Muslim. And they understand that in the context of empowerment. And my sons understand that with my daughter, which is really important. So I think there's, and even in Bradford, when we had the Bradley politics, to me, you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. If those people have only known that kind of power politics, until you don't introduce them to something which is alternative and present something which is more empowering, then how do they know what the difference is? You know, you've got to take people on a journey with you. And I think every country is the same. And in Pakistan has got Bradford. Bradford has got a large diaspora community, but it's also got one of the youngest populations in the UK. And that, not just UK, in the whole of Europe. So that's a huge strength. So it's about focusing on our strengths and empowering people to understand. Because misogyny exists everywhere, Jeremy, let's be honest. You know, a couple of years ago when we had on Park Lane, when we had the President's Club dinner, you know, and the kind of stuff that was happening there. That was in modern day Britain in this century, where we had the misogyny that was experienced at that event, which was then cancelled. So it's misogyny exists everywhere, patriarchy exists everywhere, but it's about empowering and working with communities. And I think it's about empowering women to take their space, but more so getting the men to understand that that's not a threat, that if we empower our women in our communities, we can, you know, we can thrive as a community together. And as a community, as a city, as a country, you know, however, as a world. So women need to take their space and men need to encourage that and not feel threatened by it. But you'll always get a handful of that too.
That's why education matters, isn't it?
Yeah. That's one of my big things, because I didn't have an education. So I went back to university. So I went back to college to do an access course to get into university. So I got two equivalents of GCSEs and A-levels. But they were, I never went back to university. And it's one of the things that I wish I'd have had the chance to go back to university. And I wouldn't write that off, because I'm 50 in a few years' time, and it's something that I wouldn't mind even dabbling in through the Open University to just apply some discipline to my life.
That's really hard. The Open University is the university I admire most, actually, because people who are studying there, they've got to really, really crack the whip on themselves.
Yeah, it'd be hard, but it's something I have considered. I mean, I've been considering it ever since I got into Parliament, but I've just not had the time. You know, we've had free elections, Jeremy, in the last 6 years. We've had free prime ministers. We've had, you know, Jeremy Corbyn as a leader. Now we've got Keir Starmer as a leader. You know, and we've had Brexit in between, and now we've got COVID. So 6 years of politics is like so much. I mean, you've been interviewing politicians for years. You know, it's never been this. I've never known it to be this chaotic. I don't know what your feeling is, but the chaos in the last 6 years has been a lot. It really has. Re-elections.
Do you want to get up the greasy pole in politics? Do you want to become a party leader or anything like that?
No, I've got no ambitions as such. No ambitions as such. My ambition was, when I came into politics, it was to change change the dial for Bradford. I think by the next few years, I think, you know, the work that I'm doing, I think will influence some of that. And if I achieve that, then I've done my job. You know, I think politics, some people, it's, you know, career politicians, it's something that they're there for, you know, for life, and they've spent years and years in Parliament. I can't see myself, being there as a party leader, definitely not. I've got no ambitions to do that.
So what do you want to do with your life?
I've got three children, amazing children. My youngest is just 9 at the moment. So when I came in, he was 3 years old. I've missed a lot of that. What I want to do is bring inward investment into Bradford. My constituency of Bradford, if I can get that investment and shift the dial, then I've done my job. I want to carry on with advocating on education and women. That's my big passion, because I think women empowered is, you know, it's beneficial to people and the communities. And I think I also have a real passion around the issue of Islamophobia, because I feel like I'm an empowered Muslim woman. And, you know, this whole idea of what Muslims are in the world and the kind of narrative that we've had in the last few years, some of that I really, really want to challenge. That's something I'm really, really passionate about. So I think equality. But I'm also, Jeremy, the other thing is, because I'm Shadow Minister for Community Cohesion, and the other thing I've noticed is, whilst I've been working on this brief for over last year, is that what we don't have is brave conversations in politics. And when I say brave conversations, so when I've talked about education and achievement and attainment and people going in and social mobility, if we have social mobility right, we address lots and lots of issues. And Bradford has just been ranked the number one for social mobility university. But actually, there's a whole generation of men, in particular white men, who don't go to university. And we're not having those kind of conversations, because there's so much of that conversation which is hijacked by the far right, that we don't do enough as politicians. And I think, you know, I feel that Farage wasn't made overnight. Brexit didn't happen overnight. We all know that. It happened over years and years. And I think that was a lack of leadership. And I think politics was devoid of leadership for a very, very, very long time. And I think we need some of that back. And I think when I listen to Joe Biden, and I'll tell you who really, really is inspiring me at the moment, is the conversations that I hear from Anna Sawa in Scotland. So I interviewed him, because I've got my own TV show on British Muslim TV now on a Friday night, and I try to showcase stuff and showcase Muslims and showcase people who are dealing with issues. So I had Angela Rayner on this week, and Shoma, who's been around, you know, who's done lots of work with her book, and we talked about that. And it's really, really, what I find is that we need a narrative of a unity and humanity back in politics. And I feel that we're really, really missing that at the moment. And I just, if I was something that I could, if I had a magic wand and I had something to do, that's what I'd want a politics of peace and unity rather than a politics of division. And I like what Anna Sarwar is saying at the moment, is that he really, really inspired me about the conversations around Scotland. And when he came on, he said lots of things which were really inspiring. And I think that's the kind of politics I'd want to support.
But you can't be in favour of Scottish independence and in favour of the Union. You simply can't do it. And when you try to get inward investment in Bradford West, you're going to be up against other places that want inward investment. What do you say?
Yeah.
So I'm in favour of a union in Scotland. I'm in favour of what Anna Sarwar is saying about having a politics which is unified and not separated. And I'm in favour of that. And yes, there is conflicting priorities for the government as a whole. But to me, I'm going to just lobby for Bradford West. And I think I can make the case for Bradford West. I would love to see Bradford West being the green capital, the green capital of the UK, because we've got the young population. Did you know, I found out that Bradford has the softest water in the country, which is why Bradford was the powerhouse for when the industry of cotton and, you know, we've got velvet from Bradford, Manningham Mills, which is in my constituency, which adorns the Oval Office in the White House. You know, we've got the history of Bradford. It used to be the biggest powerhouse outside of London in the UK. There is so much heritage there. The buildings are so beautiful. I just feel that Bradford needs that. You know, the old industrial kind of, there has to be a renaissance in Bradford. And I think I'm gonna be supporting. I think in 5 years' time, I'd love to do another interview with you and say to you, do you know what, this is what's happened in the last 5 years. Because I can see it happening. I really, really can.
I hope you don't get beaten down.
Nah, people like me don't get beaten down. It's like, you know, there was come on, how many times is, you know, statistically, where should I be? I've got both parents were in prison. Father was convicted, for his drug dealing. My mother was in prison for killing an abusive partner. I've done campaigns. Statistically, me and my brother and sister, we lost our home, we lost everything, and here I am talking to Jeremy Paxman. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I still have that OMG moment of watching you on telly for years, and here I am having that conversation, and that's a privilege. I have a TV show, but what would statistically, where should I be, Jeremy? And statistically, where should, you know, statistically, Bradford's got better chances than what I had of being here talking to you today. So why can't it happen? And I'm never one for why. It's always why not, you know? And it has been. It's got me so far, and I'm going to make sure Bradford gets there too. It's got to happen.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, in the spirit of unity, who's your favourite Tory MP?
So I really like Penny Mordaunt. Penny, because I worked with her during the... Burial Amendment, and I found she was really, really... And Simon Clark, who was my opposite number at the time. And even... even now, this is, so I get on as a person with Philip Davis really well, and I get on with Steve Baker really well. I think that as people, their politics are very different, but as individuals, you know, in Bradford, Philip and I have good conversations about Bradford, and we have lots and lots of, you know, with we have lots of differences, to put it bluntly, is, but as people, we got on really, really well. You know, I could imagine challenge Philip, and he's married to Esther McVeigh, but I could imagine us sitting together and having a really, really good conversation and teasing out some of that stuff, which I think is really important. You know, Andrew Percy, I got on really well with Andrew. I got on quite. Victoria Atkins, again, fellow member of the Home Affairs Select Committee. There's quite a few people, quite a few Tories that I do genuinely get on with.
And you wouldn't be averse to having a meal with them or anything?
No, not at all, because I think politics is one of the things that I firmly believe in. There's nobody who goes into the House of Parliament who doesn't believe that they're making a difference. I've yet to come across people who, you know, it'd fit a better narrative. I think they didn't mean to, you know, if they weren't as, how can I put it? So everybody, including Boris Johnson, including everybody who I've really, really got serious concerns about what they do and how they go about their things, they believe in a political ideology and in a way of doing things which is different to mine. And that's the difference. But there isn't anybody who's going into politics to say, do you know what? I want to make it hard for people out there. I don't want to make it easy for my constituents. There isn't. And one of the things as a constituency MP, if you're a strong constituency MP, you'll do the best for your constituents. You might not fit, you know, you might not politically agree with somebody or their political ideology or the way they do it. So I really, really do struggle with political ideology of a Tory party. But as people, that doesn't mean to say I don't hate anybody. I think that's, I dislike the politics, but I don't dislike the people. Some people I really do, you know, I struggle with it. I think, you know, come on, get a grip, you know, Priti Patel, for example. Do you know, I really, really, but as a person, could I have a conversation with Priti? I'd be happy to have a conversation with Priti, because Priti and I are so, you know, so different, and we've got so much different ideologies, but I'd have that conversation, because without conversations, where are we going to, we're never going to get to a position where we're having even a conversation to be able to influence. And isn't the whole point of politics to influence and change things?
Oh, is there anyone like you in Parliament?
Yeah, I'd like to think there are. With COVID, it's hard to, you know, I've got some amazing, amazing women in Parliament that I really, really admire. And I think, you know, certainly in the 2015 intake, who are really, really making their mark. And I think they're amazing people. So, yeah.
Who are these people who are like you in Parliament?
Angela Rayner. Angela Rayner hasn't come up through the normal career path in politics. So I think she's somebody I find a lot in common with, of just making a difference to communities. But also, I remember my police chief superintendent, when I first came into politics, and he sat there and he said to me, who do you think are the people in your intake who will, from a leadership perspective, do you think will be real influencers? And I mentioned Joe Cox was in that list, Stephen Kinnock, because again, don't forget, Jeremy, I came in for a very different route of politics. You know, within a year, I didn't know lots of my fellow parliamentary candidates, which is, I wasn't part of a Labour Party machinery. I hadn't been out. Loads of them came up and campaigned with me, which I was really grateful for. The ones that came up and campaigned in Bradford West, I got to know them through that experience. But I didn't have that kind of Labour Party understanding of how things worked in the Labour Party or anything. I was a member of the party, but we had a constituency Labour Party that had been suspended for years because of Rugby politics. So I had no real grasp on things at the time. And then, you know, Louise Hay, I've got a lot of time for Louise. I've got a lot of time for, you know, Jess Phillips at the time. I felt that she was going to make a real difference. And I think, you know, this week, what I've seen of her, I've really liked her stance on things. I've, you know, Wes Streeting. There's quite a few people who came into my intake who I thought were, you know, I thought would Joe was definitely, from what I remember of Joe, she was definitely in that list of people that I thought would be making a difference.
Who was asking you these questions? I thought you said a police superintendent or something.
Yeah, it was the police superintendent. Simon Atkin and I once sat there and said to me, so who do you think, you know, out of your intake, what is it like? We were just having a general conversation about politics, and says, who do you think will be the movers and the shakers of the next, you know, are there any future leaders in there? And I just went off this list and I thought, you know, I think they've got potential. I think they're good. I think they're good. Do you know? So we had this conversation, like you do. But I'll never forget that conversation.
Does skin colour make any difference?
Yes, of course it does. Of course it does. There was one incident which I'll probably write about after I leave politics, which was because I'd never ever put it in. Actually, there was two big incidents I think which I experienced in politics, and they were both at the hands of very powerful men, both white men. And they're not, and I just don't see, I think what that requires is brave conversations, and I don't see, you've got to learn from them and you've got to influence those people. And I think for both of those people that made those comments, I influenced them. I remember one time being literally reduced to tears because of how I'd been treated. And I sat there it was at an event and it was at a table, and I sat there and I thought, you know what? I get this. I need you to understand why I was experiencing it, how I was feeling about it, and how I'd turn it around. And I went over after the event and paid a genuine compliment to the person who'd not been so nice to me, and got deliberately engaged in a conversation, because I thought, you have clearly some kind of prejudice and opinion about me, and I want to shift that. Because one of the things about life is, we have people who have prejudices, and we don't take responsibility of shifting those, and we don't take responsibility of influencing others. So if somebody has got a bad opinion of me, then I need to understand where that's come from. And if I understand where that's come from, I have to take responsibility to change that perception. And there'll be times when you can't, it doesn't matter, right? They will have that opinion because they genuinely just don't like you, and that's fine, that's okay. But where you can have brave conversations and influence somebody to say, look, you might have got me wrong, but I'm happy to work with you, then I think that's the way we move forward. We have to take those responsibilities. And because you've got to give some compassion to other people as well, Jeremy, because not everybody, I don't believe that we as a people are made to hate. I just don't believe that. I just believe that we are innately people who have goodness in us. And I think sometimes people's experiences make them angry, people's experiences make them hurt, people's experiences help them. You know, years ago, when I was 5 years old, my mum was mugged outside. We were walking to nursery, to Green Lane Nursery, and she was mugged, and it was a black guy who'd held her wrist, and she ended up in hospital with a dislocated wrist. And she'd gone to the guy had gone to the hospital, and he'd had stitches in his head because my mum kind of hit him and ran off. And when he held her, I couldn't have been more than 5-6 years old. And that experience, did that give me as a child a subconscious idea of what that black person was? And I think it did. And that I had to really, really understand that. And as you grow up, if we don't take responsibilities for our conditioning, then I think we're not going to raise the next generation. We're just going to go more deeper into the narrative of division. So I think we have to take responsibility. And I take responsibility. If somebody has a bad opinion about me, I'd be happy to sit down with them and explain myself. I really, really will.
Naz, what everyone's been talking about this week is about that Meghan and Harry interview and her comment that the royal family were racist. Do you think this is a racist country?
So I think there's a lot of prejudice, but there's prejudice in every country. I think there is prejudice in this country. I think there is prejudice about, so my children have talked about it, I've talked about it, but it's not, so there's different levels, isn't there? There's different experiences. So if you don't understand something and you're ignorant of it, like I was, you know, I got suspended for anti-Semitism. It's not something I'm proud of, but it was ignorant. And I remember Ian Birrell was sat there in Portcullis House, and he says, oh, what are you going to say about it? And I says, well, I was ignorant. You can't say that. Politicians can't say that. You can't say it. No, well, why can't you? We're human beings. We don't know everything. And not everybody knows everything about different cultures. But the thing is, and this is why I keep coming back to the idea of brave conversations, we need to allow people to ask questions without fearing. I'd much rather, and Shora said this on my show, said, I'd much rather you ask me a question and say, well, I want to understand this. But we have to create that space for people to ask those questions, because we don't understand everything about different people's cultures. You know, it's we just don't. And is that's just been part of human nature. As a country, do I think we're racist? I think we've got prejudices. I think there's prejudices in every layer. I think there is institutional racism. I think there is institutions. There's structures which don't allow people to thrive and be themselves and bring their whole selves into whatever they're doing. And I'll give you an example. You know, I said earlier I'm passionate about leadership. So I'm on the strategic command course at the police for the future chief constable. I do a diversity session there. I do diversity leadership development at the NHS Leadership Academy. And often what happens is, so, and I say this to the police officers, so what you'll do is when you go into leadership development, the institutions and the NHS did to me, we're going to give you these masterclasses for BAME senior leaders. So you go on to these masterclasses and that'll allow you to get further up in your career. But these are designed just for you because of your culture or because of your skin colour. So that to me is saying the problem is you. We're going to put you all in a room together. You need to fix it and you need to become more like the system is, rather than saying we need a cultural shift to embrace you with all your diversity, and we need to encompass everybody rather than, you know, becoming more of the same. And that's the difference, Jeremy. The difference is we want people to be able to bring their authentic self into positions of leadership, because nobody, it's like you just said to me, you're a sellout, you know, you've sold out. It's like how many people when they get into positions of power and high positions of power are called sellouts, because we shouldn't have to become more of the same to be authentic leaders. I just don't think we should. I think we should be able to be able to be our authentic selves. I mean, of course, I can't use the language that I used 20 years ago. If you saw my documentary from 1995, it was 2000. I'll send you the link. You know, the language I used in that, my language was very, very different. I don't clearly use the same language when I'm sat on the green benches. I've got to, you know, you've got to amend your communication style, and that's okay, but you still got to be authentic.
Are you an optimist?
Oh, God, yeah. Hell yeah. What's not to be optimistic about? You know, it's just, we're privileged. I'm privileged. I'm sat in Great Britain. I'm sat in, you know, I'm a member of Parliament, Jeremy. How many girls coming from where I came from, you know, witnessing what I witnessed are here? You know, how many girls would be here? And what's not to be optimistic about? I've got three beautiful children. I'm talking to you. You know, it's like, I remember when I, you know, it's one of my, you know, when you've kind of like in politics, you've kind of like made it when you've had an interview with such and such and such and such. To me, it was like, you know, when we talk about Pakistan, when I go to Pakistan, I have interviews with a couple of the big anchors. And it's like, when you describe them, well, who are they? Are they the Andrew Marr? Are they the Jeremy Paxman? Are they the Nick Robinson kind of thing? You know, so to me, it's like, it's privileges, isn't it? It's honours, but, you know, there's everything to be optimistic about. Everything. Even in the post-COVID world.
It's been a pleasure speaking to you today.
Thank you.
What a pity we weren't. Do you drink or not?
No,
you don't.
Teetotal.
So do you ever go to a pub?
So I'd happily go to a pub. I mean, I've been into Strangers twice, and they've made me a lemonade. They developed a drink. Somebody said to me, I said, look, give me something that's non-alcoholic. And they made me a lemonade shandy thing. And I had that. And then the next time I went in, which was about probably a couple of years later, the barman wasn't the same, so I didn't get it again. So it was just a Coke that I got. But yeah, I went to Hajj, Jeremy, in 2 years ago. I was the last cohort before COVID, and I went to Hajj, and I'm a practicing Muslim, so I get a lot of my strength and, you know, courage from my deen. because my religion, my identity, a lot of that comes from that.
Is it incredibly crowded, the Hajj?
It is incredibly crowded, it is, but it's an experience and a half, because it's like you've got people from all over the world of all different skin colours, and everybody, you're just there for the same thing. And the most enormous thing is you're travelling in one direction and you're all saying the same prayer. You know, and when I hear that prayer, it just gives you goosebumps, because it's like you're all travelling towards God and that oneness, and it's just unified. There's millions of people. How they manage millions of people in that space, I'll never understand. But there's millions of people just doing the same thing, and it's that unity, and it's like the whole world is there. It's just absolutely amazing.
Did you feel changed by it?
Did I?
Feel changed by it?
Did I feel changed? I felt much more better in terms of my establishment of my prayer. Was it a life-changing experience? I think it's life-changing, isn't that I've met one of my obligations as a Muslim to complete my Hajj. I've done that. So that kind of like empowers me. Was it life-changing? It was life-changing in some ways, but it wasn't one of those, you know, when people say you go to the Hajj and that's it, your whole life is kind of like, you know, them kind of like miraculous experiences. It wasn't that to me. What it was is it strengthened me as a person. And it didn't, you know, I didn't come back. Some people wondered whether I'd come back and wear the hijab, you know, and I didn't, you know, I wore the hijab whilst I was there, when I travelled, you know, makeup free with a hijab all the way throughout. When I came back, I went back to being a politician, and I went back to being mum and back to being everything. But I think what it did is internally it gave me a lot of strength.
Do you think we understand? I don't really understand what it must be like to be. I mean, for example, just take something very simple. You sometimes see male Muslims with red hair. Is that, that's because they've been on the Hajj, is it?
No, so red hair, it's really interesting, right? So my grandma, God rest her soul, she used to wear Mendi henna. So a lot of them wear henna, and it's like bright red or gingery colour. And henna is something which is good for your hair, and it's good. It's a natural colourant. And henna is, you know, different depending on who you speak to, because I'm not a theologian, but there's lots of narratives developed in the community that henna is good for you, and it's something that is seen upon to do is good. So my grandmother used to have that red hair. I mean, when I remember when she had dementia, it was really difficult to colour her hair. And my granddad had the same kind of orange beard when I was quite close to him. So I think that red hair is just the henna, and it's not associated with the Hajj or anything. With the Hajj, if anything, what's associated with the Hajj and Umrah is a smaller pilgrimage, is men usually shave their hair. So they come back with bald heads because they shave it.
This is fascinating. And it's Ramadan soon, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Ramadan in a few weeks, so we're kind of like gearing up to, you know, get my body into shape to do it.
It sounds awful, because there's so much of the day you can't eat.
It's actually, first few days are really difficult, so you go through these, there's these really good guides now, and technology is amazing, because there's good apps that show you that the first day this is what will happen. So you really struggle, your tongue, that kind of dryness and all the rest of it. And then by day 10 or day 8, you're kind of like detoxified, and your energy levels boost up. And your energy levels boost up because it's using all your reserves. And it's actually a brilliant detox, right? You should, even if it's not, a lot of people do intermittent fasting, it's a big thing. Well, my mother's been doing intermittent fasting, not because it was intermittent fasting, but because it was one of the good things to do from a religious point of view for the last, you know, I think it was more than 20 years. And it helps her, because she's 67, and she's 68, and she's got better figure than me. You know, so it does work. So intermittent fasting, there's a lot of things that we do, which are kind of like now in the Western world is understood as, you know, really, really good hacks of keeping fit and stuff. But a detox, that yearly detox really does, it helps you kind of reset the dial on yourself as a person. It makes you concentrate on you. And you need to concentrate on you, because you have to be the best version of you to be, you know, to be the best version of you as a human being, and that helps you. It really does.
I've heard people, you know, saying that there's going to be a Muslim takeover in the West. Listening to you, it doesn't sound like that.
Do you know, the hilarious thing is, right, and I heard this, I can't take credit for this, it was Baroness Varsity who said it, where she joked one time and she said, oh, we're less than 5% of the population, but somehow we're going to have a Muslim takeover of the UK and Sharia law and everything else. And the hilarious thing is, if you look at Sharia law, the first tenet of Sharia law is that you've got to abide by the law of the land, whichever land you're in. You know, so that's the first tenet of Sharia law. So there's nothing about Sharia law that is going to come into this country and we're going to take over. I'm quite happy with the British laws that I've, you know, I'm quite happy with, you know, behaving in a way which is, you know, a British fact. Because there's no conflict whatsoever, Jeremy, between my Islamic values and British values. If anything, British values have changed over the years. You know, there was, I remember the leaflets that I saw when I came into politics that the Tory party used, if you, you know, using an N-word and saying, if you want an N for your neighbour, vote Labour. There were homophobic leaflets. There was all of that. Whereas, you know, that British values has evolved over time to encompass differences and all. But, you know, to me, Islamic values, Muslim values have always been human values. I think they get misinterpreted. I think people use them, and that's with anything in life. You've always got your extremists who want to form in on something, and your radicals, and they want to turn something into, it means turn it into something else. And that happens in all cultures and all communities. But genuinely, if you look at all religions, and there's no takeover. I can reassure your listeners, there's no takeover by Sharia councils or Sharia courts, as they're known. There's none of that happening. Muslims are very, very much part of the fabric of British society, and we're very proud of it. You know, some of the charity work that goes on amongst British charities and Muslim charities, especially during Christmas, I think it's brilliant. We did there was a big lovely cup of tea campaign over Christmas. You know, Christmas is one of those times where Muslims try and reach out. And then there's this whole thing about, oh, well, we don't celebrate Christmas and all. You know, I've got a big Christmas tree every year. I mean, my daughter put it on a Snapchat and she does get the odd text. Well, you can't be, you've got that ignorance of, hang on a minute, you've got a Christmas tree in the background. You do presents on Christmas Day. Yeah, it's a big part of our, you know, my kids love Christmas. They love their Christmas presents. No, I mean, I think it's not just because of the Christmas present. I did a big turkey and I did a big lamb this Christmas. You know, I did the whole trimmings and everything. So there's not, and many Muslims, you know, we're not in a box. You know, there's different things about us and where we, you know, we contribute to different aspects of British life, just like you do and others do.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Naz. Good luck to you.
Thanks, Jeremy. Thank you.
Well, there you are, Naz Shah. A walking rebuke to the lazy commonplace that our politicians are all the same. They're not. Next week, we've got Jake Fiennes, yet another distinguished member of the Fiennes clan, and no less accomplished in his own line of work, which happens to be the conservation and restoration of wild habitats, specifically on the Holcombe Estate in Norfolk. He's a man who knows his warblers from his robins, and we had a lovely chat about birdsong, birds, hedges, the important things in life. Do join us for that, and in the meantime, keep buggering on.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.